Managing Violence Podcast, episode 73, with Debbie Stephen. Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Managing Violence Podcast. Great to have you back again. Today, I am joined by Debbie Stephen. Debbie is a karate expert. She's a successful dojo owner and a martial arts business person. But she's also done an amazing amount of work with her not-for-profit organization, helping disadvantaged women in a variety of countries, South Africa, India, as well as in the UK. And she does some amazing work. We're talking today about gender-based violence. And I know for some of you, that's going to be a topic that challenges you a little bit. But I really challenge you to listen, to learn, to take an open mind. Sometimes these terms have got baggage attached to them, but that's the actual point. There's a lot of baggage when it comes to gender-based violence. So whether you're male or female, I encourage you to listen to this podcast because it will certainly shift your perspective, perhaps, if it's not a topic that you know a lot about. Now, before I get to Debbie, I just want to give you one piece of exciting news. My new book, Neon Jungle, A Bouncer's True Tales of Lessons, Laughs, and Lacerations, is now available on Amazon everywhere in the world. The ebook is out now. The print version should be out in the next couple of days everywhere except Australia. A little bit of a personal slight there from Amazon against the Aussies, but everywhere else except for Australia, you can get the print version of Neon Jungle in the next couple of days, or just grab the Kindle version right now. That's Neon Jungle, A Bouncer's True Tales of Lessons, Laughs, and Lacerations. I'll make sure I put the link in the show notes. Without further ado, here is Ms. Debbie Stephen. I'm joined here on the Managing Violence Podcast by Debbie Stephen. Debbie, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Joe. It's awesome to be here.
Now, Debbie, we've just had a chat offline about the martial arts fraternity and some of the work you've done that maybe it's flown under the radar in terms of the martial arts or self-defense world, but you've done some incredible things that we will get you to talk about as we go on. But Debbie is a champion in the fight against gender-based violence. She teaches young girls and vulnerable women how to protect themselves, also coaching empathy and awareness for young men. She has an incredible story in her own right. She's done some amazing things in countries all over the world, and it's an absolute pleasure to sit and talk with her this evening. So, Debbie, as I said, welcome to the show, and I can't wait to learn.
Thanks. Thanks so much, Joe.
Debbie, for those with a keen ear will detect that you are South African. You are based in the UK, working out of India, South Africa, and anywhere else?
India, South Africa, and actually the UK.
Okay, right. So I guess things have been challenging this year in terms of being able to maintain
exactly.
A globe-trotting
life. It's been interesting.
Let's start at the very beginning, though. What's your introduction to this world? I know you had some childhood events that sort of set you on this path. So let's just tell your story for listeners.
Yeah, thank you so much, Joe. By the time I was, I'm South African, obviously, as Joe said, by the time I was 10 years old, I had been raped twice. And I think this is a really important story to share because I see a lot of content with regards to self-defense teachings, looking at perpetrators only being of a certain of a certain type. And we focus a lot on perpetrators being people from other people's communities. Wherever I've taught in the world, somebody's blaming somebody else's community for being the bad person. For me, it wasn't like that. For me, it was just my friend's brothers, older brothers that raped me. So the reason I share that story is that very, very early on, I realized that it wasn't a monster, that I realized it was somebody within my community. And the lessons that perhaps my parents and society had taught me even at that young age was that it would be like, you know, it's that rape happens in a certain way. There was nothing in the narrative of what people were sharing with me that mirrored in any way the experience that I had. Like so many other young girls and young guys, my decision was at a very young age was like, well, I better keep quiet. And I think I already knew and understood patriarchy. I already knew that as a 10-year-old girl, irrespective of what had happened to me, I would almost certainly be blamed. I knew that my parents would probably be angry with me, not specifically my parents, but this is what happens with child abuse. I'm not saying that they would have been angry with me. They would have been horrified and supported me, but I thought that they would be angry with me because I understood at that age already that women get blamed for men's bad behavior. So I, like so many other people, stayed quiet. And then, I don't know, it must have been, luckily for me, I moved from one city. So I moved from Port Elizabeth to Durban. And I took it in like in my stride. I was like, wow, this is an amazing opportunity. I can reinvent myself. So I can pretend all of that stuff didn't happen to me. And I can just be like the new Debbie. And I think a lot of us don't realize, I know that Richard Dimitri's partner, Pamela, talks a lot about trauma and trauma response. We don't realize how important trauma is and how, as young children, we cope with trauma. We just shut things out. We just block things off. So I had done that for a couple of years, but do feel that inside I was deeply traumatized, obviously, with what had happened. I also believed as a young girl and then as a teenage girl, and then even in my 20s, to be honest with you, Joe, I did believe actually that all men have if they had the opportunity, would actually rape. I mean, that was my experience of men, which is not like that anymore. For all the guys out there, that's not what I believe now. But as a young girl, I did believe that. And when I was at school, one day a martial arts club came to my school. And I was like, wow, this is amazing. Like, you know, I heard Savannah talking and I thought, wow, one of your people you interviewed. And I thought, wow, this is me. I can learn to fight. And like her, rather naively, I thought that if I became some kind of fighting machine, that would help me protect myself and that I wouldn't have this bad experience again. And so I'd run home and go say to my parents, I'm so excited. Please, please. Like, there's a karate club at my school and can I join? And my parents said no. And it was, you know, this is probably in the sort of early to mid 80s. And they said no. And it was because I was a girl. It's like, you can't do karate. Like, that's not what girls do. And so, you know, unfortunately, for a couple of years, they shut me out that opportunity. But the minute I got a job and I was driving to a friend of mine's farm with her brother in the car, and he was telling me about the fact that he was a martial artist, like he did Shotokan karate. And I was like, oh, that's amazing. Like, can I do it or am I too old? I was 19. And they said, no, he was like, you can definitely do it. And so it was a really big learning step for me, Joe, because I started training karate. And, you know, like Savannah, I guess, I went ballistic. I was like training 6 days a week in a totally male dominated environment. I had an experience with my first karate instructor, Sensei Barry Anderson. And he had called me aside one day and he had said to me, well, you know, Debbie, like, we're going to have to ask you to leave the club. And I said, what? Like, what are you talking about? Because I was like, I'm the best student. Like, I'm training the hardest. I'm the most committed. Like, I'm here all the time. And he said, we've had a number of complaints about you. And I thought, wow, that's weird. Because, you know, people think that when you raped, that your the way you view men is like very aggressive and that you hate men. And in actual fact, it's not that at all. I was a very enthusiastic student and I was frightened of men. I mean, that was the reality. So when I said to him, like, so what are the complaints? He said, well, the men are complaining you're hitting them too hard. And so that was the first, and one of the guys opened his gi top and he showed me like my fist tattooed onto his chest. And I realized a really important thing. Like, I apologized to this guy. I said, oh my God, I'm so sorry. I didn't realize that you felt pain. Like, you're a guy. Like, honestly, I didn't think that you felt it because everyone around me, the whole of society, have told me that guys are strong and don't feel pain. So I then learned, obviously, I wasn't kicked out the club. I then learned and I carried on developing a karate business. Now in London, I have 52 dojos. I have 700 before COVID-19. I had 52 dojos. I had 700 students. I have hosted 2 world karate tournaments where the entire panel of people were women, the most successful, the most well attended, the most countries. The guys come back and back and back because the tournament is so well organized. And the only criteria or the only thing in our head, the team of women that one of my instructors, Simona, that was sort of my partner in it, the only thing we wanted was it to be the best for the athlete. That was it. It wasn't about ego. It wasn't about money. It was, how can this be the fairest for everyone? So I had this massive karate career. I competed in the South African All-Stars karate team, blah, blah, blah. But every time that something happened, Joe, I kept thinking, this actually isn't enough. This isn't for me. This wouldn't have helped me, actually. So I started looking at what would help. And I started training with a lot of the international guys because, as I said to you earlier on, there is, without any doubt, an international self-defense fraternity of badass guys out there. And as a woman, for 90% of my career, I have been excluded from that. I have been bumped off chairs. I have been, I have been called a woman self-defense instructor, although I'm a self-defense instructor. I've gone through many, many, many of the challenges, I guess, of being a woman in a very male-dominated space. But I have trained with some incredible people. And I think for me, training with Richard Dimitri, I was the first Senshido at the time, his school Senshido qualified instructor in the UK, male or female. I was the first person in the UK to fly out to Montreal and be put through his hectic instructor's course, which he unfortunately doesn't do that course anymore. He's also evolved and developed, over time.
I was also an instructor under Rich, just for
okay.
I'm familiar.
So when I say I was the first person to do that 10-day course, you understand what we went through.
Zombie week, huh?
Yeah, I loved it. I have only fond memories of it. I mean, I remember walking around Montreal and thinking like, oh my God, like at any moment, he's going to get one of his students to attack me in the street. It was like that. But one of the things that I really respected about, and I still respect about Rich, other than the fact that he continuously evolves with many, which many instructors don't, he also started, we had a very similar idea about psychology and looking at how things work out with regards to violence. So that was a massive influence on me. And I then also, I think when I'd come back from Montreal, I was very conscious that I were, like many instructors, I was teaching to pay my rent. I had karate businesses that I was developing. I had a very separate business called Premier Self Defense, which I was teaching reality-based self-defense to corporates and schools and stuff, men, women, and young people. But for me, my heart is in service. Like, I understand, I grew up in South Africa, I understand discrimination, I grew up in patriarchy. South Africa's incredibly patriarchal country. I understand patriarchy. And I also understand poverty. And I was very aware that people could only come on my workshops if they had enough money, or could only attend other people's workshops if they paid. And I realized that very, very few people were doing something for nothing. And so I changed everything that I did to decide that I wanted to set up a charity in the UK called Action Break Silence. And I wanted to provide the services of what I was charging people for free of charge. And actually last year in the COVID, I've decided to shut my business and only have a charity so that, anyone that does pay, the money doesn't come to me. The money goes into the charity, and it basically pays for people to do their course. So that's sort of a tiny background on how I've gone from young to old, Joe, and got to where, got to this interview.
Yeah, wow, that's incredible. There's like 3 or 4 episodes worth of material that we've just covered that I could pull on threads and drag out. But I'm really interested in, I guess, Action Break Silence, primarily because of the demographics you're working with, the communities you're working with, I think to set the scene, and look, I disclosed to you before we started recording, somewhere between 92 and 97% of the audience of this show are male, and yeah, as am I. And I think it's hard sometimes to be aware of someone's suffering or someone's plight outside of your own experience. And certainly for me, I always taught both genders, but I certainly didn't get female problems the way that I understood young male problems. I'm a dad to four daughters now, which changes your perspective on what's important. And it's something that has really, my eyes have started to open to the challenges. My oldest is 8, going 9, going 27. I'm seeing issues that she's facing and things that are happening at school. And I'm like, oh my God, this stuff that I wasn't ready for is starting to happen. And I'm becoming more and more aware of the challenges that she's going to face as I try and equip her as best I can. So I think probably as a starting point, let's talk about what gender-based violence is and what is the scale of it, especially beyond the first world country environment that you know, majority of our listeners have a certain level of first world comfort. What is the scale of the problem that you're actually fighting?
I often wonder if it was men and boys that were being put through what women and girls have been put through since the beginning of time, how different the public response to that violence would be. I think that there's a war on women. I think the number of women that are suffering internationally is catastrophic. Cyril Ramaphosa calls it the second pandemic in South Africa. Although the restrictions and laws and regulations and attention that's been given to COVID-19 has never been given to gender-based violence. I think it's an international issue. Unfortunately, and again, I hope, hopefully, because I know your audience is male and I want to be really upfront, you will see as we're going through the interview, I have absolute empathy for men. I have evolved in the way I think, and I have really looked at patriarchy and understand that it's not just women that have been severely impacted by that, it's actually men. So, but the gender-based violence is, I think one of the things that I think a lot of guys don't get is when they think of gender-based violence, they think of like rape. So if I said to guys, what do you think the worst thing that a woman could go through? Guys would say like, oh, being gang raped. And I think to be fair, that's a lot of, you know, when you ask women, you'll get a very similar answer. For me, if you look at violence on a pyramid, and you look at the top of that pyramid as the worst thing or something that can happen once in our lives. So once in our lives, we can be raped and murdered, all right? And at the bottom of that pyramid, you look at stuff that women are experiencing every single day, multiple times a day. And it's that stuff on the bottom of that pyramid, Joe, that impacts our daily life, takes away our right to happiness, our right to freedom, and our right to live our lives to the best of our abilities. So these things at the bottom are what's already impacting your 8-year-old daughter. So I will guarantee you, if I said to you, do you think your 8-year-old daughter has suffered gender-based violence? Most guys will say, oh, no. But if we asked your daughter, has a boy slapped you on the bum? Has a boy pulled your ponytails? And what we don't get is that's the start. And actually those things of bra snapping and pinching bums and slapping breasts or, you know, that kind of stuff that's happening when kids are 7 to 10 years old is already catastrophically impacting those girls' ability to go to school and feel 100% safe. And as you know, guys often do this in teams. So there is great intimidation and a lot of young girls feel feel nervous about actually going through. For me, I think gender-based violence is the obvious things, but I think what's often missed is all of the things beneath those big ones. And I think when men teach self-defense, they focus on like the rapes and the sexual assaults and muggings maybe. But what they're not looking at is two things. One, who are the people doing that? and how does it actually happen? Because I know, again, when I was listening to Savannah, she was saying like size counts, and you know, you need to not be a princess, which I find slightly, you know, I don't know, I find it slightly insulting to women that happen to be really, really beautiful. And it means that if you're a beautiful, amazing woman, that you're not a warrior. And I think that's a problem for me. But that, you know, that there is this massive section that people are, they're not looking at the perpetrators, and they're excluding a lot of stuff that's limiting our ability to be a woman. And I think for me, that's a big thing, Joe.
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack in what you've just said there. Look, you're bang on the money. I mean, this past year, I mean, there was one moment that was like a real, I won't say it was an epiphany moment because I was on the lookout for it, but I mean, my daughter had a boy at school that was writing her letters, and she was writing letters back to him, and it was all very cute. And his mum was saying that he was sticking my daughter's letters up on his wall beside his bed, and he was like completely smitten with her. She knows she's not having any boyfriends because she's eight. And he eventually asked her to be his girlfriend, and she said, no, I'm not allowed to have boyfriends. And he got very upset, and he destroyed all the letters, and it absolutely broke her heart that he reacted violently, even if it was just to the things that she had made him or given to him that had significance to her, because she didn't give him what he wanted. And you know, the next day, obviously, he was embarrassed, and they made friends again. But it was just a glimpse of the emotional trauma and the emotional violence that takes place, where he expected one thing to go a certain way and she said no. And I was, you know, obviously we highly encouraged her to you know, say no.
Set boundaries and say no. Yeah.
And to stick to what she wanted, and not to give in because there was an emotional blackmail going on. But I mean, yeah, I mean, that's 8 years old, right? So
I think, Joe, the interesting thing about what we've said, if we like unpack it, all right, so we understand what happened to your daughter. We understand that this guy responded violently by ripping up and tearing and stuff. But my thing is that what I started looking at in the last 10 years is really trying to not judge that eight-year-old boy, and to really look at why that boy did what he did.
Absolutely.
And this is something that I've looked at a lot. I forgot to mention that I've done a master's degree in women and child abuse as well. So I've done a huge amount of academic research behind everything that I'm saying. And for me, that young boy, I mean, you know, like I've said this a couple of times. So let's just imagine, like, we could put 100 young boys, like this particular young boy, and like some young boys from India and some young boys from like some of the, you know, some, let's just have a diverse group of boys from all over the world. Because this is, when it comes to gender-based violence, I think borders and boundaries are eradicated. Because experiences that I've spoken to women and girls all over the world are very similar. And when I've spoken to boys, the way they are brought up is very similar. So, of course, there's cultural differences and we respect that. But imagine if we could have like a stage and we could have 100, including this little boy that did this to your daughter, this young chap that did this to your daughter, is let's have a stage with 100 young boys on it. And for us as the public, for you as a dad, for your partner or wife, as a woman, as a woman, you know, let's just have a whole audience looking at those boys. And if they were 3 years old and we asked the audience, what do you think? You can't look at a three-year-old boy and not go, oh my God, he is so cute. You know, because that's what you do. 3 years old is just adorable, male or female, is adorable. And so it's at that age that patriarchy starts. It's at that age that men are already conscious of their duty to follow masculinity. And it's already at that time that society starts putting pressure on boys. And for me, I think there's a very thin line. When you stop a young boy feeling, it's child abuse. You know, I'm very strong on that. It's child abuse. And I know that a lot of this audience out there is men that are listening. And just really think about it. How many times when you were under 8 years old, were you told to man up? Were you told the minute you tried to express yourself as a young child, you were knocked, not just by perhaps a family member, but by peers at school, but by teachers, but by society, and all sorts of media stuff that you were already seeing. So for me, I feel that by the time young boys are 8 years old, their belief system is already starting to set, Joe. And I think that that's something that we sort of developed a men's program, was how do we allow guys to be able to express yourself? And that young boy that tore up your daughter's letters, he just didn't know how to say, because his whole life, if you communicate, you're not masculine. If you share your feelings, you're not masculine. And so I think that it gets to a point that the only way boys can express themselves, even at 8 years old, is through rage.
Yeah. And look, that's the conversation we had with her as well, is that, you know, she hasn't grown up in a family where destruction is a response to emotion. Right. And so she was very confused, and she thought, but he's so nice, and I like him. And why is he a bad person? He's not a bad person. He just didn't know how to deal with an embarrassing situation.
He didn't know how to say.
Yeah. He didn't.
He was hurt. He was hurt because
he didn't have any healthy responses to that. And look, he's a kid. I'm sure he'll learn more skills. There's nothing wrong with his family, but it's just one of those things. It's sort of like that. That's a glimpse, right? That's a glimpse of the challenge. I'd like to switch gears a little bit and have a look at some of the challenges you've had, or maybe some of the stories you've had working in India, working in South Africa, working with communities that may suffer higher degrees of oppression or less legal representation, or whatever other challenges may be posed in some of those communities.
Yes, I've been very privileged, Joe, to work in India, and to work in South Africa. I've done some work in South America as well. And to be really, really honest, I've worked in some of the poorest communities, and I've worked with in the same countries with some of the wealthiest people when I've done private work and corporate work. And again, I have to say that, you know, if you look at COVID-19 as an example, people talk about, we also want to blame everyone as well. It's the same with gender-based violence. So when I'm in India, people often blame people in the cities, were blaming rural people coming into the cities to find work, and poor, uneducated people. And so I think this is a big thing with gender-based violence, and probably violence as a whole, is that we always want to point fingers. My work in India, I think we've taught 35,000 women and young boys in India, and the same huge amount of people in South Africa. I think one of the things that's incredible is Action Break Silence has come up with a community intervention. So this is being taught in India and South Africa, and we're about to launch it in the UK. And the response from the young boys and the young girls in India is not dissimilar to the response from the boys in South Africa, and boys and girls in South Africa, and is not dissimilar to the response of the boys and girls in the UK. So as much as I'm not quite sure, to be honest with you, my work in India is really no different to the work that I'm doing in South Africa. And I think, like I was saying earlier on in the interview with regards to gender-based violence, when I was asking young girls, when I first went to India, I went to an area in south of India where there had been no Western woman. So they had not seen anyone from outside, people in their own community. I had to work through a translator, which is difficult. I didn't understand how different a translation from Malayalam, which is a local language, to English is. You know, we think as English speaking people, we think that if I say like dog, then in Malayalam or Hindi, dog would be just one word, and it doesn't work like that. So it was really, really interesting working in India, and particularly at the beginning when I was using translators, and seeing the response from those young Indian girls. And one of the things a lot of people used to say to me was like, how is it that you've managed to get girls from extremely poor communities where patriarchy is so entrenched into culture? How are you able to get those young girls to just go ballistic? Because at the end of our empowerment through self-defense workshops, we have an attack like a lot of people do. And the woman, if you see the videos or clips online, the woman went absolutely ballistic. And I think it's the same. I think when you give women permission to be their authentic selves, I think whether they are young women in Soweto or other parts of South Africa or India or in the UK, when women believe that they have, you know, that they're allowed to be violent, then incredible things happen. And I think as much as I was talking to you about the young boy and about how boys are socialized, I think we as women, when we are young, we socialize. So boys are being told not to feel and not to talk and not to show any form of emotion other than aggression. Girls are taught that we need to talk and we need to express ourselves, and but we can't be aggressive. I mean, that's the big thing. We can't be aggressive and we can't shout, we can't scream, and we definitely can't be physical. So you have these two little people growing up so differently. And I think, in it, you know, when we start looking at adult women and we start looking at the way we empower women, one of the things that I think is important is that right to actually be their authentic self. Like you said with your daughter, I think teaching kids at a really young age about boundaries and setting boundaries and sticking to boundaries is really, really important. So that's sort of in a nutshell. We've worked, the charity has worked all over India. Again, initially, we were just teaching women self-defense, whether it was young girls or whether it was women. And then as with the rest of the sort of, I guess, the other countries that we're working in, we started looking at having a wholer approach. So one of the things that Action Break Silence has developed is a community intervention. So this is taught again in India and South Africa and the UK, where we look at upskilling young unemployed people to become phenomenal, incredible trainers. So I think for me, the myth of you have to have a black belt and you've got to be a badass and you've got to have years of martial arts experience to be able to teach an empowerment or feminist self-defense workshop is not true. And then a big thing, Joe, is that we have the schools intervention. And this is something that we teach in India, South Africa, and the UK, as you said at the beginning, where we're teaching girls to be empowered and set boundaries and boys to feel empathy and become active bystanders.
Mm-hmm. That was actually my next question, was what sort of, how does Action Break Silence actually look on the ground? I mean, are you doing long-term training? Is it workshops? Is it a series of workshops? Is there ongoing training with their communities? How does it actually work on a practical level?
So one of the things that as a charity and me as a person, I think doing the master's degree was life-changing, because I had an opportunity to really look at research, international research, in what was working and what wasn't working. So I was very much teaching parachute interventions. So I was going in and teaching, you know, it doesn't matter about the hours, 2, 4, 6, 8 hours, but I was going in teaching a group of women or girls and then leaving. I hadn't had any focus on young boys at the time. And over the sort of, the charity was founded in the UK in 2013 and then in South Africa in 2015 and then as a fully fledged Indian charity last year. So one of the things that I learned was for us to truly have change in society, because you've been involved in this industry a long time, Joe. Like I don't want to do something unless it's going to have societal change. I don't want your daughter to go through what I went through. I don't want her to live in a world where she knows that even now in Australia, UK, South Africa, India, if she was raped and it went to court, I mean, in the UK, it's a first world country, 1% of men that commit rape ever spend a day in jail. So like, that's the world that we women live in. So how do we change that? So what I did is looked at the research and realized we need to have a longer intervention. So the Action Break Silence community intervention is like the holy grail of what we do. So it's getting the entire community involved in changing the way, I guess, the way they view women, and very importantly, the way they view men as well. Because unless we change the way boys and girls are socialized, violence will continue. We know that 90% of violence is perpetrated by men. So unless there is a focus on men, nothing's going to change. So one of the things that I would ask and reach out to everyone listening is to question if you're a phenomenal self-defense instructor, all right, and you have years of experience and passion and all of those things that's needed to become successful in this industry, why is it that you're not teaching boys to not behave like that? Because you are role models, you are guys. Like, why is it a woman that has come up with a program for young boys rather than all of you that have been involved in this industry for your entire lives? And so you're teaching men to defend themselves, or men to be, in your things, bad asses or whatever. But what about teaching men not to perpetrate? And so the action break, yep.
No, sorry, I was just going to echo that. It just reminded me of a conversation I had with a coach years ago, and I won't give any more details about him because I don't want him to feel identified. But he was running a kids program that was attracting a lot of kids that weren't from the best of homes, and I noticed a couple of kids, and I said, I want to talk to this kid about this issue and that issue. Like, there's just some stuff going on, and he said, "Oh, mate, I'm a XYZ coach. I'm not a social worker. I don't want to be a social worker. The home life is their life." But yet, if you take any martial art or boxing, or how many stories are there of this kid was on a path towards jail, and they found the sport and it turned their life around and gave them meaning and they became an upstanding citizen? Like, there's so many stories like that that have happened basically accidentally because a kid found direction and found a positive role model. Exactly. Imagine how much that could be amplified if we actually had a structured program to help those kids as well. Because I know that the ones that have that great story are probably 1%, and the rest of them go in there, they learn some skills, they get kicked out because they lack discipline, or they get into a scuffle or something, and they're booted out and they're back on the street. So if we already have a vehicle where we can achieve that by accident, imagine how much we can achieve if we were more deliberate and intentional about it.
Exactly. And the thing is, you've I think so the boys program that I developed or designed was really based on two theories. So I was looking at the social norms theory, which is really looking at our response as human beings, because we think other people think we think. Basically, that's it in a nutshell. So often young boys behave in a certain way because they think the boys around them think that they would behave in that way. And so the social norms theory was, how can we change, literally, how can we change behavior by changing what is socially accepted? So if you look at all that ponytail pulling and bra snapping and all of that, as a society, we go, oh, well, that's just boys being boys. Well, actually, no, that's not. That's creating quite a bad experience for a young girl. It's not nice for a young girl. And I know that I did my master's dissertation in Soweto. And one of the things, Joe, that I was like really, really surprised at, like, I did a load of focus groups with 11, 12, 13 year old boys, and talking to them about sexual harassment and talking to them about their role in preventing sexual harassment. And could they become active bystanders? Like, is there another way forward for young boys other than being part of that group that's intimidating girls? Is there another role for boys? And I was so surprised when I talked to these young boys, how many of them felt bad. Like, they said to me, like, we actually, yes, Debbie, I have abused, I have harassed, I have sexually assaulted, but I don't want to do that. But the peer pressure is so huge on young boys to conform to that toxic masculine behavior that they kind of felt helpless. So the boys program that I designed was really looking at what options could we give guys so that they're able to become, so that they're able to become active bystanders. So for us, the boys program was really looking at the foundation of the program was looking at self-love, looking at self-competence, and doing a number of exercises where young boys were able to try and understand a range of emotions and to express those emotions. So, and also to talk about the types of abuse. And that's something that I said to you earlier on, is that a lot of the young guys, they didn't realize that what they were doing was actually abusive. So if we asked 100 adult men, have you raped a woman? Then I would guarantee you 70% of those guys would say no. And then if we asked the same 100 people, have you had sex where you think perhaps the woman didn't really want to do it? Like, she wasn't really that into it. Then that number is going to go up quite quickly. If I ask women, how many of you have been raped? 70% would say no. And if I ask those so many same women, how many of you have had sex when you didn't want to have sex? 90% of those women will put their hand up. And so this is something that's really important to look at, is like, what is rape? And how does it look? And what does sexual harassment do? So with regards to what Action Break Silence does, is we do a 12-hour program where we look at a school, because I was speaking to Benjamin and he was saying, like, he did some work. He got Richard involved in some work somewhere in South America, I think. And he was saying to me, I'm so overwhelmed by the problem. Like, I'm so overwhelmed by how many women are being hurt. And like, as a father, I'm like panicking. And I think for me as well, Joe, I was like, how can I make a difference as one person? Like, I want to teach for free. I know that. I don't want this to be about me. I want to upskill other people. But how can I change gender-based violence? So I brought everything in and I thought, okay, well, I can't. I mean, it would be ridiculous to think that I'm going to have an impact on the world. But can I have an impact on one school? So that school that your daughter goes to, if we went into that school and we ran for the, we upskilled people in that community. So we upskilled people that understood the nuances of going to that school. They understood the culture around that school. They were from the same socioeconomic level. How would we upskill those people? And then very importantly, the girls would go through an empowerment. And this is a feminist self-defense workshop. And people often freak out, particularly guys, when you mention the word feminism. But it's just meaning putting women at the center of their own issues, really. So listening to what young girls actually go through, stuff like that, what your daughter's just been through. And girls go through this empowerment through self-defense and active bystander program. So teaching young girls how to be active supporters and good listeners to other young girls. And then the boys do the hero empathy and active bystander program. So giving them a role in learning to become allies with women, like learning to stand up, maybe not stand up. We're not saying stand up to a guy that's like smashing his mother's face in, but actually the guy at school that is sexually harassing a young girl, to actually say, you know what you're doing isn't actually right. Like, that's not cool. And how do you give guys, also, how do you empower guys to stand up in a world where patriarchy is so, you know, so strong still? And then very important, looking at the sort of whole school's approach, is not just teaching the kids, but actually talking to the parents. And saying to the parents, do you understand? Let's talk about like toxic masculinity. Let's talk about those little things when your daughter comes to you and says, like, I don't like that boy, that you listen. Or when your son expresses himself, don't call him like, you know, don't call him a sissy, because that is damaging. It's got long-term damage. So we get the parents involved as well, and then also the teachers involved. And that's sort of an outline of the Action Break Silence program.
Yeah, wow. That's incredible. And I really like the structure, and I like that it's, what was the word, hero empathy? Was it
hero empathy and active bystander.
I like that. I really like that, because it actually makes empathy something heroic. It's something that they can aspire towards. It's not a quote unquote feminine thing. It's heroic, which is, I really like that as a I can still connect to the young boy mentality. I think that's very, very cool. Just as we come towards the conclusion of the interview, one thing I really wanted to ask you, because I know a lot of our listeners are martial arts instructors, they are teaching, and look, if they're like the majority of clubs that I know, the majority of them probably teaching majority boys and men. But there are some out there that will have majority women, and some that will have a 50-50 balance and so on. One of the things that I've observed through a lifetime of martial arts is that the numbers between boys and girls doing martial arts seem to be fairly even until about the age of 11, 12, and then a lot of the girls drift away. And they don't come back unless they happen to come back many years later. Once their kids are doing it, they might get back on the mat and they might start doing some things to reconnect to that passion. And we always kind of, as boys and as young men instructors, we thought, oh, they're getting to an age where having bruises isn't cool anymore. You know, like they're starting to pursue more feminine characteristics. But looking back on it now, I do wonder whether how much of that was just a discomfort with proximity or with individuals or with culture or just the fact that they probably had male instructors that didn't really get it and didn't really know how to help with those issues. So it's a long, very long way of me asking, but for male instructors out there that are trying to do the right thing by young girls and by their female students, what sort of advice do you give them on how to do this well?
I'm a firm believer in communication, you know, and I think often male instructors presume how we feel as women without actually seriously sitting us down and talking to us. So in my martial arts clubs, I don't have that at all. So my clubs are very, very equally split between men and women, boys and girls. And as they become teenagers, we seem to hang on to them. And I think that's because we create an environment that has, I guess that is that just doesn't have space for patriarchy or ego with guys. And we know when boys become teenagers, a whole bunch of stuff changes. And I think that environment does become quite threatening for young girls. I would really encourage instructors to talk to the woman in their club, and to have perhaps to really think about having some women role models and women leaders, developing women as instructors. I have in my martial arts club, I have an apprenticeship scheme. So when our students get their junior black belt, guys and girls get their junior black belt, I employ them as instructors because I'm a big, firm believer in youth. And I think that those instructors would mentor the students, you know, mentor the kids a little bit younger than them better. So in our junior instructor scheme, we have equal number of young women role models as we do young guys. And I think perhaps that's one of the reasons why we retain our women students. So I would look at perhaps having an apprenticeship scheme within their club and promoting an equal gender so that women aren't always taught by teenage guys or always taught by men, that they actually have women that they can aspire to and women that are incredible role models.
That makes a lot of sense, and it sounds like something that should be standard, but I'm just off the top of my head, I can't think of too many clubs that I'm aware of, at least locally, that do that, and that is really interesting. The other question I have for you on that, and it is something that I'm just curious about your opinion on, when it comes to pure self-defense for women, when we're actually teaching women self-defense classes, are you a fan of the women's only classes or mixed classes or combination thereof? Where do you stand? What are your thoughts on that particular question?
I think as women, I mean, as with men, we are so all very different, you know, so I don't think we should have a one box fits all. I think we should have options. I think the advantages of having an all women's class is that women feel that that's a safe place, that they can express themselves, they can share stories. And I think this is why sometimes it's good to have a woman instructor rather than a guy. Although I do know a number of male instructors that are absolute honeys. I mean, they do, you know, I would imagine, Joe, I don't know you, but just in the call today, I would imagine you were one of those people, you know, that you would feel comfortable as a woman opening up and talking to about like an experience. So I know that there are lots of you guys out there that women do open up to, but I do think that, so that's the biggest thing. I think creating a space where women feel that they can share their stories, because again, like I said, with my story, it's not like it is in the movies. You know, the way I was raped wasn't like some guy coming and bashing me over the head and dragging me into the bush or punching me in the face. It often doesn't happen like that. So I would say give women an option to do all women classes, but also give women an option to come into classes with guys. And I agree with, I think it's Savannah as well, that in the environment where you've got women and men training together, it would be good to teach those guys to not pussyfoot around women, that women are there to train hard and to, you know, to get actively involved in the physical.
Yeah, my personal opinion on that is very similar. I think the women's only classes, for some groups, that's the only way they'll ever step foot in a dojo. Especially here where I live, it's a very high Muslim population. A lot of those girls, if there was not a women's only class, they would just never be there. Like it's
exactly.
Especially something like jiu-jitsu or something that's high contact. If they were one of a handful of girls in an all male class, they would just not train.
So is it not better they train something, right? Even if you could argue, even if you had a strong opinion that it wasn't optimal, it's still better than no training. So I think especially for those, from my experience, having run some all women's classes, which is always a little bit awkward when you're a male instructor, but running an all women's class, sometimes you can recognize there are people that just need to do a couple of months of the all women's classes to feel like they've built some skills so they can almost like they're armed so they can go into the regular classes and they're not going to be embarrassed or they've felt it out. They know it's for them. They're going to push on now. So I think they really have their place, but.
I think, yeah. And I think also there's two things, Joe. I think you said that they're armed and they can, so you almost have a stepping stone. I think it's not just only the fact that they might feel physically more competent. I actually think that being in those classes builds their mental strength. And I think that's something that a lot of people neglect, is that how do you get a woman that has been brought up in a patriarchal society where violence and resistance is seen as masculine and you will be ridiculed for it? How do you get that woman to feel okay to put a finger down the back of somebody's eye socket? Like, how do you do that? And I think it's not through becoming physically more competent, because you don't need to be physically competent to put your finger into the back of somebody's eye socket. It's to believe that you actually have the right to do that. Yeah. And I think that's something that we should all be working on with women, as much as I think when we're looking at toxic masculinity, we have to work at breaking all of that down so that guys can just be who they want to be, their authentic selves. And at the same time, working on women and getting them to understand that actually it's okay for them to be aggressive. It's okay for them to be loud. I don't know if you've ever done this before, but if you get if you say to a group of 30 women, I want you to get up individually, stand on this table and scream as loud as you can. And then ask them why they won't get up on the table. It's not that they lack physical strength. They're like, oh my God, you're asking me to step outside of my gender norm. You're telling me to do what society, the thing we've been drummed into us the most as women, is to keep quiet. So I can't do that. It's too hectic. And if I do it as an instructor and I get up on the stage and I scream, the feeling, the emotion that those women are feeling is embarrassment. Mm. They're embarrassed for me. And so that's something, again, when you're looking at teaching women and you're looking at women being okay with physical resistance, you have to first get them to understand that it's okay to step outside of what the entire world has told them to do since they were 3 years old.
Mm. I have to say, the first confusion I had over this, well, I was about 23, 24, and I was teaching predominantly nurses at the time. And so mostly female population. And most people that go into nursing tend to be a little bit martyristic to begin with. And they put others ahead of themselves. And I was teaching a healthcare aggression course. So we're not only trying to teach them how to defend themselves, but defend themselves against their patients, like the people that they've spent their entire lives trying to protect and care for and look after. And it doesn't matter how many times you tell someone that nurses are the most assaulted profession in the world, it still doesn't really tend to sink in. I will say that the exception to that was emergency department nurses. They tend to hate everybody, so they're fine. But everybody else, it really took almost more therapy than training to reconnect them to this idea that you are worth fighting for. And so a lot of the times the trigger had to be connecting them to a threat on their child. And then they could reconnect to that primal instinct of actually doing damage to another human being because it seems acceptable at that point. So that is, it was certainly an experience. And it's something, having trained predominantly men before that, I didn't really understand. Like, well, what do you mean you don't want to hurt somebody? Isn't that why you're here? But it's a completely different, it was a completely different mentality. And obviously, being 23, 24 myself, I didn't really get it straight away. But
we evolve, huh?
Yeah, well, hopefully. So some people seem to defy that, but I think generally we evolve. All right, well, we're coming up close to the end of the interview, Debbie. For those that want to know more about Action Break Silence, where can they go to find out more about what you do?
I think it's just easy, Joe. If they just Google Action Break Silence, will come up. We have two websites at the moment, a South African, which is .co.za, and a UK site, which is .org. And both sites are just literally Action Breaks with an S, another S, Silence, with the end part, .org or .co.za.
Awesome. There is a ton of media out there as well. You've been interviewed all over the place. You've been on TV, radio, and the works. There's plenty of information out there if you want to learn more. But please check out Debbie's work. She's doing amazing things for people that need it the most. And it's one of the missions of this podcast, especially in 2021. We want to shine the light on some people that are doing things for people that actually need it, not just turning your buck. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but it's nice if you can help people at the same time. So, Debbie, I thank you very much for making the time to be on the Managing Violence podcast. I know you're going to stick around and do the bonus round as well. But for those that are leaving us here, thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Joe.
Wow, that was it was a really interesting conversation there with Debbie. I really thank her for taking the time to share her story with us and certainly her perspective and her expertise in a challenging area of violence, being gender-based violence. Make sure you check out all her work moving forward. And also, just before we close, once again, remember my new book, Neon Jungle. Almost forgot what it was called. Neon Jungle, Bouncer's True Tales of Lessons, Laughs, and Lacerations. It's available on Amazon if you could pick that up. I would really appreciate it. If you like it, leave a review. If you don't like it, keep it to yourself. All right, that's it for us, guys. I will talk to you next time.